matter is John Morgan versus State of Nevada. If the parties are ready to go, they can come forward. Sit up, take your time. If you're ready to proceed, who's going to be proceeding? Moving on behalf of the appellants, Ms. Dickinson.
Your Honor, before I start, I'd like to introduce to you Nadia Hoja. She was one of the trial attorneys in this case. She's helping me out with this oral argument.
Wish to reserve time, Ms. Dickinson? Wish to reserve time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Mr. Morgan in this case. The foundation of a trial is jury selection procedures. The criminal conviction rests on this selection process because that is the way the defendant gets a fair trial. As this Court knows, if there's a problem with the jury selection process, it can be structural error. That any harm can be shown. Beginning with the procedures for the formation of the jury, the Court looks at Chapter 175 that explains the procedures in place for selecting the criminal jury. However, NRS 175.021, subsection 1, tells the District Court that trial juries for criminal actions are formed in the same manner as trial juries in civil actions. So what does that mean? It means that the District Court looks at NRS 0.030 to decide how the jury is going to be formed. Subsection 4 tells the judge that when they have the veneer list, they are to call a number of names to form a panel of prospective jurors equal to the sum of the number of regular jurors and alternate jurors to be selected, and the number of peremptory challenges to be exercised. So in this case, it meant the Court needed to call 23 prospective jurors to the jury box before beginning any voir dire. In this case, the Court only called 13.
Did the defense object to
that? They did. They did object and said, you know, this violates their right to due process. They cited an unpublished case, a Geyer case. And they said to the Court, this deprives us of a meaningful opportunity to use our peremptory challenges. Now, the problem with the
Counsel, let's back up, because you used the word peremptory challenges. Didn't the judge do the general questioning of the total panel before he called to the box?
Your Honor, as I recall, they qualified for cause only 13 jurors to begin with. Then what happened was the parties had to use their peremptory challenges, and as one was used, another person was put in there. Now, the problem with that procedure is twofold. First, it violates the statute. And secondly, what it does is it does not allow you to know who's up next coming into the box. So there's simply no way you can decide whether or not you really want to use your peremptory challenges on one of the first 13. I think it's important to realize that challenges for cause, you're just looking at one juror at a time. But when you're using peremptory challenges, what the parties are doing is how is this group of people going to react in the jury room? We're looking at group dynamics, we're no longer just looking at one person. Whereas maybe one juror may seem fine when you're only looking at 12 individually. But if you had all 23 there, it would assist you in being able to make a meaningful decision on how to use those part two challenges. This analysis comports with NRS 175.031, which states the court shall conduct the initial examination of prospective jurors and not unreasonably restrict voir dire. NRS 175.031 uses the plural of jurors. So we know that combining that with the civil rules, the judge needed to call all 23. Now, the court's arbitrary methods deny John the ability to make an intelligent and meaningful decision. There simply was no way the defense counsel could even have her client help her in deciding who should be on the jury, because nobody knew who was going to be called next. But that wasn't the only problem with jury selection. There were several other problems. For instance, the defense challenged the jury veneer. There were too few African Americans in that challenge. And unless the court has some questions about that, I'll then move to the next problem.
As to that issue in terms of the proportionality, did the objection indicate that it was intentional discrimination on the part of the state or the jury commissioner to not have a proper veneer or some indication of it? Was it only based upon a mathematical situation?
Well, there were two problems that occurred. One is that the court did not allow the jury commissioner to initially come up there for a hearing. The court didn't stop the process but continued. The only reason the court allowed testimony from the jury commissioner was because the state said, I think we need the testimony. This is after the jury selection had already been completed. So that's the first problem, which is a Brass and Buchanan problem. The second problem is the jury commissioner testified that equal number of summons are given, sent out to each zip code. What that means is those with the zip codes with a higher population will be getting fewer per capita. And as we know, minorities tend to be more in the areas where there's a higher population. So we were able to show there's a problem with the system, and that can lead to the systematic exclusion. With regard to the Batson challenge, defense objected when the state struck juror number 24, Timothy Olson. And the objection that she made was based on the questions the prosecutor asked and the fact that the prosecutor used the peremptory challenge to remove this juror and not other jurors who answered similarly.
Well, because didn't that juror say he had a partner? Was that, I think that was the terminology that was used.
Right. He said he had a partner.
Do you know if that partner is male or female? That's the thing. A lot of people have partners and maybe are heterosexual couples. Was that record developed any further?
Well, the record shows the prosecutor asked every juror if they were married, single, or divorced, but not this juror. He said he had a partner. She said, well, we have a boyfriend, a girlfriend, are you married? So the questions were different for this particular juror. Mm-hmm. When the defense objected, made a Batson challenge, the prosecutor's response was, well, he's homosexual, it was out there. And then she said his response to the media concerned her. And at that time, there was police brutality and violence in the media. And she used the words, you know, they haven't shown a pattern. I don't need to make up a reason right now. I think her response shows that her reasons that she gave were not necessarily as clear as they should be because, number one, you don't have to show a pattern. So I'm not sure why she's saying you have to. Number two, she immediately went to the fact about the media, but yet she didn't strike others who talked about the media. And number three, she kept saying, well, I don't need to respond. In fact, she did. Now, in this case, the judge didn't even let the defense respond to her questions. It just ruled. And
but that's not strictly accurate. The defense counsel appropriately pressed to argue it, and the judge entertained the argument, correct?
After the judge had said there was no pattern.
Right, but the judge did hear the person out.
She did. She did hear her out, but she had already ruled there was no pattern, and that was her ruling. And at the end also. So there was a problem procedurally with regard to that.
Yeah, it's a sidebar though, right? It was a sidebar at the bench?
I believe it was, and then they made a record.
Reading the transcript on juror 24, which was the peremptorily challenged juror, and then 27, and I think the other one was 31, it seemed to me, just even on a cold record, that 24 was much more categorical in his statement that this has gone on too long, police abuses and so on. The others seemed more, yeah, there's some merit to that, but I'm not 100%, you know, it depends on what the situation is. Could you address that?
Right. Juror 27 said dialogue and media criticism of the police was important and should be judged on a case-by-case basis. Juror 31 did not have strong feelings about the media attention, but said, I know there are bad police officers out there, and there's good police officers, and there's a reason everything happens. Juror 24, the only one who was removed, said, I feel that it's about time the police officers, the few that are abusing their authority, are being charged. I think it's gone on way too long that they've been able to abuse the public. There's nothing wrong with what he said. I think we all would agree that we do not want police abusing the public. We do not want them to be abusing defendants.
Right, but we're talking about a peremptory challenge. I mean, it seems to me that that was much more of a categorical denunciation of something that's been allowed to continue too long than the others expressed. And in the context of a peremptory challenge, it's not, you know, buying into the merits of that. It nonetheless is a difference, wouldn't you agree, between 24, 27, and 31's answers?
Well, I think all three of them acknowledge that there's good cops and bad cops.
Yeah.
24 nearly said that there are, am I down to 4 minutes?
You're at the 3:55 mark, so.
Merely said that it's gone on too long.
I have one more question before you sit down. On the issue with respect to the Lakes Crossing, the order, the transport order in 7 days, between the August order directing that your client be transported to Lakes Crossing and the actual transport, how long was the time that elapsed? The August order, and then when was he transferred?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure how much time elapsed, but I think it was at least another month.
Okay, could you look that up when you, thank you.
Yet, file something.
Perhaps your co-counsel can assist you.
That up. But I would like to point out that the competency issue began on in February of 2015.
I understand that.
So
I had a very specific question. Thank you.
If I could just briefly go on to three other issues. I'm about time. I just briefly want to point out that the court, during jury selection, used an analogy of a race car when she was talking about burden proof and fairness. The court, John objected. He asked for a new veneer because the court inaccurately compared the trial to a race. It's not a race. Defense does not have a burden of proof. In a race car,
didn't the court, and I'll use the word attempt, kind of being neutral, to clarify the position of the court?
She later on said that, you know, they have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but she never went back and said, you know, that race car analogy I used, that's not really the way the law is. So it was never said to the jury that they should not consider that. Two other things I want to talk about, I know I'm almost out of time, is that yesterday this court heard arguments in Scarpetta that the state changed the theory of their case by amending the charging document before or during trial. Here we have a similar issue. Here, the defense attorney filed a bill of particulars ahead of time, complained that the count, robbery count, was very vague. It allowed the state to change the theory of the case, and that's what they did. In closing, they changed the theory so that robbery was no longer a hitting, it was a threat. And the other issue I'm going to touch briefly on is the closing. In closing, the defense attorney said Maria Vendusco is still a manager of AMPM. Court disagreed, said that was not the evidence presented. In fact, when I went back over the evidence, what was presented, there was never anything presented saying she was no longer the manager there. This was correct. There was nothing wrong with the statement made. Yet the district court required her to apologize and restate that. And with that, I'll start.
As to, give us a record site as the last, please, because that's not my understanding of the reading. So if I'm in, I reviewed incorrectly, I'd like to know my own edification. But I think it was slightly different.
Can I look it up?
Yes. Yes, please. Ms. Graham?
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court, my name is Elana Lee Grant. I represent the respondent in this matter, the people of the state of Nevada. The Court did not err in this case in denying the defendant's Batson challenge when the state used a peremptory challenge on juror number 24. Counsel is absolutely correct. A pattern is not required. It's just one way to establish a prima facie case when making a Batson challenge. Another way to make a prima facie case is to show that the person using the challenge subjected somebody, one of the jurors that they ultimately kicked, to disparate questioning, is what the argument was. Juror number 24 was not subjected to disparate questioning whatsoever. Every single juror on the panel was asked, are you married, single, or divorced? Juror number 24 was the only juror to offer their relationship status prior to the line in question, which was, are you married, single, or divorced? The follow-up to that question is when that person indicated they had a partner, the question was boyfriend, girlfriend, or married. The aim of the question was the character of the relationship, as in, is it a dating relationship or are you married to that person? Because the very next question posed to juror number 24, as every single other juror was, tell me what that person, your spouse, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your fiance does for a living, which is of course relevant in jury selection. Because a pattern wasn't shown, because the juror number 24 was not subjected to disparate questioning, the state did not need to move on and give a neutral reason. I understand.
Why was that juror preempted, though? What was the state's reasoning?
Sure. The question posed by defense counsel during jury selection was to the panel as a whole. But what do you all think of recent media coverage of police? And at that time, there was I guess, depending on how you view it, either unfair or fair criticism of police and media. His response, which was kind of discussed earlier, was the most charged of anyone, where he felt that some should actually be charged with crimes. And the quote was directly, it's gone on way too long.
So that was the neutral reason why the jurors preempted.
That was the neutral reason that was offered. And I understand this court, in some recent unpublished opinions, have said, well, the state went ahead and defended its use of peremptory challenge, so we're going to say that you all conceded that issue. I don't know that that's clearly decided, but I certainly would implore this court to not take that as a concession, because in every legal argument, most every legal argument that an attorney makes, almost every issue, the attorney is going to cover the first prong, second prong, third prong, even though nothing is meant for the first prong. And it shouldn't be held against the state in this case, or any other case regarding the Batson challenge. There was also an issue brought up in questions posed to counsel on the veneer process. I would agree with Justice Douglas in that the district court judge in this case asked the panel as a whole a number of questions prior to turning it over to defense and the prosecutor to ask specific questions.
So, I mean, I'm just curious because I haven't been in done a trial in the new courthouse, but in the old one, they only had 13 or 14 seats. So, generally, the judges would ask the general questions the entire veneer. You know, if they could serve, you know, time questions and all that, and then they call the first 13 or 14
Correct.
And then ask specific questions. Is that how they still do it?
Well, it's interesting that you brought up in the old courthouse because some of us refer to that as the old school way of doing things.
So some
of the district court judges do it that way. Other district court judges open up not only the jury box, so to speak, but the members of the veneer who are sitting behind the panel.
Right.
Obviously, district court is accorded great deference in how they do jury selection. What's also important in the consideration on this case in this jury selection is the district court judge was open to, hey, if you guys have questions, if the parties have questions you want me to ask to the panel as a whole, go ahead and let me know what those
are. Well, Ms. Dickinson is saying she believes it violates the statute how the jury selection was done. What's your position on that?
It doesn't violate the statute.
Okay.
The questions are posed to everybody as a whole, and it doesn't prohibit whether if a juror is kicked who's in the box and then another person is brought in, you are free to ask that person every single question under the sun. Your voir dire is not limited at all simply because you don't know if that person's male, female, police officer, works for the Innocence Project. It's kind of, sorry, Charlie, out of luck, but you're able to ask that person and see if you can strike them for cause, and if not, use a peremptory challenge. And peremptory challenge, if you don't have any, then that's kind of the luck of the draw of the case. But certainly there's nothing unconstitutional or even unfair or limiting when you can ask that person as many questions as you want. Regarding the veneer process, in this case, three of the 45 members of the veneer were African-American. There was absolutely no claim made at the trial of exclusion at all whatsoever. As the court knows...
Was a record made that the parties observed, and I'm not sure how you
yes.
established that, but they appeared to be three African-Americans.
Correct. That was a challenge that was made, or a record that was made by defense. The state absolutely agreed with that. The Sixth Amendment doesn't guarantee a jury, or even a veneer, that is a perfect cross-section. This court in Williams discussed that there are going to be variables. While you have three out of 45 in this courtroom, you can go to the next courtroom over and you can have 10 of 45. There are going to be variables. There was absolutely no claim at the time of exclusion. Counsel brought up Buchanan, which is entirely different from this case. In Buchanan, there were no African Americans on the panel. The state conceded the first and second prong in that case. Not only that, but the district court in that case said, you know what, I think we should have a hearing, but then didn't hold the hearing until after the verdict was rendered. In this case, the court found, I don't find excluded, well, found that this was a fair cross-section. The defense didn't even argue exclusion. The court found we don't need a hearing, but the state, out of an abundance of trying to make a record, after the state offered, here's how the jury is selected, it's through DMV at that time, and it's through Nevada Power. Defense, will you agree to that? They did not have to agree to that, which they didn't. And so we had a hearing out of an abundance of caution, and certainly I would urge this court to not take the hearing of the jury commissioner as some sort of concession about meeting the first and second prongs of the veneer process.
Can you comment about the what Ms. Dickinson said about the change of theory?
Sure.
And whether the defense had adequate notice of the
Absolutely.
State intent to prove its case.
Absolutely. The requirement for notice is just that the defendant is placed on reasonable notice of what the charges are and what they're going to have to defend against. There were two counts in this case. There was a robbery count alleged and a battery with intent to commit robbery. The robbery count described take personal property to wit miscellaneous food items from the person of Maria Verduzco or in her presence, and then listed a number of conduct prohibited by the robbery statute in the actual information. The battery with intent was the actual striking of Maria Verduzco. The state's main theory was that when Maria confronted the defendant, who was a large man, especially in comparison with Maria, who was a small woman, confronted him and said, hey, can you just go ahead and put the property back? He told her to get the F out of his face, closed a distance of about 3 feet. Maria testified in the video show she recoiled back, gave her apprehension. She turned her face away. We argue that's a robbery, folks. That is threat of force or violence when he advances on her, cusses at her, get the F out of my face, and she's retreating. And then he went ahead and struck her. The state is entitled to, at any time, argue different theories under the same statute so long as it's a defense on notice of that. And the defendant was on notice of that because we argue threat of force, fear, or force, actual force. And we should be able to argue that. We should not be hamstrung into one theory under a robbery statute. It would be different, of course, if in the robbery statute we simply allege, and if the information we allege, everybody, we're putting you on notice, the force that we're using to convict your client of robbery is the actual striking of Maria. But we didn't do that in this case. So the juries don't have to agree on a theory, and juries should be given the choice of multiple theories to convict a defendant under the robbery statute. And it's what they did in this case. Ultimately, they acquitted him of the battery with intent to commit robbery, but the reason it was important to have both crimes charged and to be able to allege different conduct for the robbery was because there's a different intent requirement, different mens rea requirement as well. The battery with intent to commit a crime is a specific intent crime. Robbery is just a general intent crime. If there are no further questions.
I was interested in the same question I asked your opposing counsel to do with the competency hearing. And I understand the Scarborough footnote, et cetera, but I couldn't tell how long it was from the court entering the order that Mr. Morgan be transported and when the transport occurred. What was that delay?
Well, Your Honor, when Your Honor first asked, I feel like my memory is 7 days, counsel's is 30, so I can't say with confidence, okay, great confidence as I stand here today, how many more days passed before he ultimately was transported.
Okay, but in the 7 to 30 range?
Correct, that's my understanding.
They're making a request in their brief that there be some credit for time served that be a multiple for each day it exceeded 7. Could you comment on that request?
Sure. I don't think that request is based on, with all due respect, logic or reason, because he received every day of credit that he was confined, if you will, towards his ultimate sentence. If that's a penalty or a punitive punishment for the state for not transporting him, I don't think that's fair.
Okay, so he did receive credit for
absolutely
all his time in custody?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
On behalf of Mr. Morgan, here we go. It's saying you have 24 seconds. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Your Honor, with your question about the closing argument, I've talked to trial counsel. She says the court did not direct her to apologize, just directed her to change the statement. As we know from the transcript, the change was incorrect. With regard to the Batson issue.
Let's go back on that change, because it was something about is versus was. A very minor change, but nonetheless. I guess
Maria never testified that she no longer worked at AMPM. And the state brought out all of her responsibilities as a manager to the jury. So trial counsel interpreted that to mean she was still there. And that was her argument, because she never testified she no longer worked there. So that was the difference. It became an important difference because the question was whether she had any control over the missing witness. If I could go to the Batson issue briefly, I was asked about the difference between juror 24 and the other jurors. I want to point out that the court asked the entire panel if they had strong feelings about the, or John asked the entire panel if they had strong feelings about the criticisms of cops, and juror number 24 did not acknowledge strong feelings. With regard to the jury selection process, I'm concerned if we give deference to the district courts to do whatever they want, what's to stop them from, okay, we're just going to question five jurors, now start using the peremptory challenges. Well, let's just go ahead and question eight, now use your peremptory challenges. The rules are in place for a reason. Now, trial counsel informs me the new courthouse has about 20 seats in the box, and they put extra chairs down because most judges follow this procedure. With regard to the change in the theories, the state says they can change the theory anytime they want.
Finish your statement.
Can I just finish it?
Yes.
I want to point out that in the opening statement, their theory was he knocks Maria with her chest, lifting her feet off the ground, and then they changed the theory in closing. I think the fact that they believe they can change their theory shows that they don't believe they have to give us fair notice.
As that last statement, is their intent based upon the papers before the court, or is it based upon their statement in opening?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
You are predicating their change in theory upon what was said in the opening statement, opposed to the written document that was filed with the court. What is controlling?
The written document, you mean the amended information? Okay, the amended information had no facts at all for the robbery. And then when we filed the bill of particulars, we did not receive any facts. And then in opening statement, they did infer that it was the battery. In closing, they did not. So we're predicating it on everything, not just on one specific.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank the parties for their arguments this morning and their positions as to the issues presented. With that, this matter will be submitted. We stand in recess till 11:30.